Mimi Chakarova, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you have been investigating for many years a very interesting topic, this topic of human trafficking. I think that there are some ideas. It's one of those terms that we kind of have an idea of what it is, but perhaps don't know specifically what we're talking about, how it differs from smuggling, for example, and what types of trafficking exist. If you could maybe speak a little to that.
I would love to, actually, because there is such a misconception and a lot of misunderstandings as to what is human trafficking. It's a big word, and people often don't know what does it entail. We have to think about two categories, labor trafficking, so human beings who are trafficked for the purposes of labor and are exploited for that, and then sexual trafficking, sex trafficking. I have focused on the latter. However, labor trafficking throughout the world, not just in the United States of America, throughout the world is by far a bigger issue than sex trafficking. And it's very difficult to identify. It's very difficult to find those who are trafficked for labor, even sometimes more so than women trafficked for sex, because with women trafficked for sex, you go to the red light districts. You go to the places where you know there is sexual activity taking place. But with labor, it's this invisible beast. So what is trafficking? What is human trafficking? What is sex trafficking? With sex trafficking, and I'll focus on that because that's what my knowledge is on. With sex trafficking, it's important to understand the distinction between sex trafficking and prostitution. People often mix those two up, and there is a lot of confusion. Mm-hmm. Are they willingly coming? Are they selling their bodies because they want to? The answer is no. No, they're not. These are women who my work, my documentary film focused on a region that I grew up in, where I came from. So it focuses on Eastern European women who were sold for sex into the sex trade in the Middle East as well as Western Europe. And these women were offered legitimate jobs as factory workers, as waitresses, as nannies, caretakers of the elderly in places like Italy, Greece, Spain, Turkey, Israel, United Arab Emirates, and I can continue listing a whole array of countries. What I'm about to tell you applies to the United States as well. The formula is very similar in the way young females, young women are being shifted from place to place. Here in the U.S., it will be from state to state, sometimes within the same state.
And we're talking very young girls in some cases and young boys, I'm assuming, as well.
Yes.
And so the key there in the trafficking part is that in many cases, these women are lied to and put into or somehow get themselves into a situation, be it a job or something along those lines. And once they then cross that border or cross that state, they are then in a situation where they cannot get out of it for fear of their lives, passport situations. In some cases, they're being drugged, I'm assuming. How are they kept?
All of what you just mentioned is correct. And an important factor is that their documents are taken from them. So they have no longer any identity. They're often taken to, if we focus on foreign women, these are women who don't speak the language. They don't know what number to call. Even if they were to manage to run away from an apartment, you ask me how are they kept. A lot of them are kept in private residences. They're kept in houses. They're kept in apartments. They're kept in buildings. They're not necessarily brothels. A lot of them are private properties of someone who then turns their house, their apartment or their home into a brothel where men know whether it's online or whether it's from another fellow guy who frequents these kinds of establishments that there are women that you can have sex with that are a lot cheaper. And they are cheaper because they're trafficked women and because these women are not making a single penny. The pimps and the traffickers collect all of it. So a trafficker will bring a woman, deliver her to the destination city or country, and sell her for a price depending on her age, depending on her nationality, depending on all kinds of other things that really sound like pricing a horse or a cattle, and would price her and sell her. And now this woman becomes the property of a pimp. And this pimp makes decisions on her behalf as to how many clients she will have per day. And he will transport her from place to place. And this cycle of debt, he will say to her, I paid money for you. So if you ever want to buy your freedom, it's going to cost you, you know, in some places, it would be some exuberant amount that you have to work off for me in order for you to gain your freedom. So it's a lot of brainwashing. It's a lot of violence. It's important for people to realize the amount of violence that these women endure. I'm often asked, well, why couldn't they just escape? You know, and it's such, and I understand why people are compelled to ask that question. But you have to understand the conditions under which these women are kept and the conditions under which they're broken down. Their spirit is broken down to do this type of work, if you even want to call it work, which I think it's the wrong word to use. It's not work, this exploitation.
It's always struck me, too. We often think of traffickers and those involved in these organizations and think of them as male, but there are a lot of women involved in this as well. It kind of seems like going against one's gender to be putting other young girls in this sort of situation. But women are playing an increasingly large role in these circles, from my understanding.
Women are playing a very significant role. Every girl I interviewed in my film, The Price of Sex, was trafficked by a woman. Women are more likely to trust women. So the criminal networks know how to use women to their advantage. They'll send a woman into a community, and that woman will recruit younger females. And those younger females would believe the woman that, yes, there is a legitimate job someplace, and if they just allow this woman to situate their paperwork and their documents, they can trust her and go with her. This woman is, in fact, the trafficker. This woman is, in fact, the person who goes through that transaction between the pimp and the delivery of the goods, if you want to call it that way. She delivers the women, she receives payment, and then she recruits more. And that's the cycle. And yes, a lot of them are women. And it's tragic. But also, I think people, again, have this misconception that this is all run by men. No, there is we play a huge part in this as well.
Well, and you mentioned your documentary, the award-winning documentary, The Price of Sex, which seems to have a double meaning. I think when we talk about trafficking, we're very much talking about, in its crassest sense, a supply and demand and a commodity. But the price of sex, we're also talking about the price that these young women face if they do get away or somehow escape. The emotional tolls that they must face must be incredible. And I think it's so remarkable you've spent a decade researching for this film. You seem to get incredible access to these young girls. And I wonder how you got that access and what were some of the stories or some of the things they shared with you? And how did they respond to you asking them about something that would seem so personal?
It took a long time. And I was very naive at the beginning. I thought that it might take a year and a half, maybe 2 years to really get young women to talk about what had happened to them. It ended up in some cases taking 4 or 5 years to get really the full story of their trafficking experience. Establishing trust, especially with people who have been deeply traumatized emotionally and psychologically, and physically as well, takes a long period of time to gain access into their life, to be allowed to actually film, spend time with them, not only interview them, but be on camera. It took a very long time, more than I ever anticipated. Some of the stories, you know, some of the questions I asked were very difficult to ask. And often I had to gauge if the time was appropriate for those questions to be asked. I always wanted to know what are the conditions from which these girls came from, because there is a pattern. Trafficking, sex trafficking in particular, but also labor trafficking. It affects people who are desperate. It affects those young people, and I say young people because the age group, the age range keeps dropping. It used to be 18 to 24. Now, you know, we're seeing kids that are 11 and 12 that are being trafficked for sex.
And they're coming from very poor parts of the world.
They're coming from very poor parts of the world. They're coming, and not just parts of the world. You know, I use this example all the time. I live in California. Just 15 minutes from my house, there is a place called International Boulevard in Oakland, California, where I could be driving at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I would see 12 and 13-year-old girls that are on the street, pimped out. And to me, this is just in my backyard. And these are kids. And these are kids who don't want to press charges because they have been brainwashed and manipulated and beaten and abused by their pimps who initially were their boyfriends. And I want to share this story because you asked me about questions. You know, I've also interviewed a lot of pimps. I've interviewed the demand side of this. I've interviewed the people who control these women. And I've interviewed people here in the United States as well, trying to understand the psychology behind why do they do what they do and how do they recruit girls. And I remember this conversation with a man who said, I'll go to a mall and I'll see a girl, not with her friends, but by herself. So I would think, interesting. She's sitting there by herself and she looks kind of sad. And I'll go to her because, you know, he'll assume maybe she has family issues. Maybe she's trying to, you know, take some time away from home, from school. I'll go to her and I'll say, you have such pretty blue eyes or such pretty brown eyes. And I'll watch what she says. If she says, thank you, I wouldn't go for her. But if she says, no, I don't. If she shows me lack of self-esteem, lack of confidence, then I know I can work with that. I can manipulate her. I can recruit her. I can make her feel special. And that's how it all starts in a lot of situations.
That's strategic.
That's strategic.
And it seems like these pimps were willing to talk with you. I think that was the other thing that was somewhat striking. Now, this is obviously a very difficult topic and very, very sad on many levels. But is there any hope? Are we becoming more aware of the situation? Are there things that can be done or are being done to perhaps end on a slightly more positive note?
There is a lot of hope. There is not hope, and I want to end on a realistic note. There is not hope in eliminating the problem because I think that's unrealistic. But there is hope in reducing the numbers. And we reduce the numbers by making people aware, first and foremost, because you'll be surprised how many people still do not know what is this thing called human trafficking. What does it entail? And who does it affect? So first and foremost, presenting information to people. Secondly, training law enforcement in a way that they handle raids and they handle these women and these young men as well with compassion and with empathy and don't treat them as criminals.
They're victims.
Victims. It's very important to understand that and to offer the proper training. So after we released the film, the United States State Department got in touch and they wanted to use the price of sex as a training tool in embassies throughout the world. That's a very positive step. The United Nations Office for Drugs and Organized Crime reached out and wanted to discuss anti-corruption practices. We're talking about global steps in the right direction. But yes, training law enforcement and also accountability. That's the last missing piece of a very important equation. If traffickers are held accountable, if the judicial system delivers the proper punishment for the crime of putting these women through what they put them through, then you will see a reduction. But there is also one last thing, the demand. And that's the most difficult part of that equation, the demand. We have to change perceptions. We have to change the perceptions of those who purchase the services of these women. They have to understand that these women are not doing this willingly. They have to understand that each time they pay for this, it's rape. And I think once there is enough noise, once there is enough of a ripple effect, we can actually start looking at demand changing.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you for having me.